leader!
Order, order.
Resuming at 2 on Tuesday after a week's adjournment, Parliament began a 3-week sitting period that will run through to the week before Easter, which is earlier than usual this year with Good Friday on March the 25th, and then they'll be back for another 3 weeks ending in mid-April. Question time on Tuesday was followed by resumption of the debate on the Prime Minister's statement. It's 13 hours interrupted every day during the first 2 weeks for the government to make some progress on legislation. It finally came to an end just before 9:30 on Tuesday night, with the House voting on the government's confidence motion, the result announced by Assistant Speaker Lindsay Tish.
Members, the ayes are 63, the noes are 58. The motion is agreed to.
The opposition's motion of no confidence in John Key's National-led minority government was defeated by the same margin, with Mr Key's majority secured by formal agreements with the Māori Party, United Future's Peter Dunn, and the ACT Party's David Seymour. They add 4 votes to National's 59, but only on issues involving confidence and money supply and procedural motions requiring a majority in the chamber, such as when the House goes into urgency. Otherwise, those parties are free to vote as they please, and the potential for the Māori Party and Peter Dunn to cross the floor and add their 3 votes to the 58 of Labour, the Greens and New Zealand First, giving the opposition the majority of 61 to defeat the government, was narrowly avoided the following night when debate on a members' bill was interrupted by the adjournment at 10. It was on the Environmental Protection Authority, Protection of Environment Amendment Bill, which, and I quote, amends the Environmental Protection Authority Act of 2011 to add an additional objective that the organisation must aim to protect, maintain and enhance New Zealand's environment. End quote. An apparently obvious tautology for an organisation called the Environmental Protection Authority. A no-brainer, you'd think, and both sides would agree with you. The government's saying that its purpose is obvious in the title and the amendment is unnecessary. And the opposition saying it's needed because the authority's purpose is not explicitly stated in the Act. Sponsored by Labour's Mecca Fightery, the MP for the Eastern North Island Māori seat of Ikaroa Rafiti, the bill was drawn from the members' ballot in March last year. Its first reading debate ended with it being sent to the Local Government and Environment Committee after Peter Dunn and the Māori Party voted with the opposition, giving them 61 votes to defeat the 60 of National and ACT. On the committee, though, National MPs outnumber the opposition members 6-5, and despite receiving support in all but 8 of the 206 submissions, the bill has been reported back to the Chamber with a recommendation that it not be passed. Debate on the bill's second reading on the order paper below 3 private bills on Wednesday night was interrupted about halfway through, so its eventual fate won't be known until at least the next Members' Day, scheduled for Wednesday, March the 16th. And while that bill rides on the narrowest of margins, a government bill advanced on the widest of margins on Tuesday night, with Lindsay Tish still on the chair.
Members, the ayes are 120, the noes are 1, the motion is agreed to.
And so the Building, Earthquake-Prone Buildings Amendment Bill was given a second reading, opposed only by the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour.
In fact, Mr Speaker, some analysis of the initial bill said that the Auckland population would be spending 3,000 times more to save a life than people in Wellington. We Aucklanders know that while for our excesses and sins we may well one day drown in runs of lava from our many volcanoes, the risk of an earthquake in our part of the country is practically nil.
While Mr Seymour stood alone in opposing the imposition of a national standard, regardless of the variation in risk, Labour's Ian Lees-Galloway laid out his party's conditions for supporting the government's Employment Standards Amendment Bill.
We want to remove the ability for employers to put people on contracts where they are on call with no permanent hours. That is a zero-hours contract, and that is the situation that the legislation as currently drafted allows for.
Employers should not be allowed to cancel shifts at the last minute.
We are concerned right now that the legislation is not strong enough on this matter. It does allow for last-minute cancellations, and in fact, if anything, it suggests that cancellation of shifts should be normalised, that cancellation clauses should go into every employment agreement, and we do not agree with that. We need that to be changed.
Where practicable, hours of work should be included in an employment agreement.
So that people can plan their lives and have income security. Those are our bottom lines. Those are the changes we need to see in order to continue supporting this legislation.
Although the government would have the numbers without Labor's support, Workplace Relations and Safety Minister Michael Woodhouse held out hope of some small concessions.
There was a strong backlash from some who claimed that rather than eliminate zero-hours provisions, the bill had entrenched them. I absolutely disagree with that assessment, but felt that for all the hyperbole, the gap between where we were and those views wasn't as large as the drum beating would suggest. I am prepared to make further minor changes to the clauses around availability and the definition of reasonable notice to close that gap.
And Mr Woodhouse's success in closing that gap will be tested when the Employment Standards Amendment Bill enters its next stage in the Chamber in the coming week. Now to the committee rooms with Rhys Lyon.
On Wednesday, former Northland MP John Carter was back at Parliament, appearing in one of the committee rooms.
Well, I've got to tell you, it's great to be free. Every day is a great day when you're not in Parliament.
Mr Carter is now Mayor of the Far North District Council and was back in Wellington to make a submission to a bill before the Commerce Committee.
It's actually like putting on an old coat, but Madam Chair and committee members, it is nice to be back actually.
Mr Carter spoke in support of a bill which seeks to grant limited concessions around shop trading on Easter Sunday.
We support the bill, mainly because we have anomalies that, for example, in Pyhare, the businesses carry on, in Russell, just across the water, they can't, and it's nuts.
While supporting the proposed law change around Easter trading, Mr Carter pleaded with the committee on one point of its implementation.
Please do not load us onto local government through, I'm not allowed to swear, am I, in here? Blimmin' bylaws. Please don't put it through bylaws. It is hugely difficult, time-consuming, and what we would recommend and what local government have recommended is that we have a policy setting, and quite honestly, I would much rather that came from Parliament.
Far North District Mayor John Carter, and that submission was followed by Family First Director Bob McCoskrey.
Well, just to bring total contrast to the previous submitter, we reject any liberalisation of Easter trading laws and we reject this proposal. Economic improvement needs to be finely balanced with family and community time. And in New Zealand, half of Anzac Day, Easter and Christmas remain the few times when the whole country stops and takes a break. If anything, we would argue they should be expanded.
Mr McCoskrey argued against the economic reasoning behind the bill.
I acknowledge that the benefits of a workforce taking holidays as a nation is not quantifiable. It's difficult to quantify the value of work-life balance, but the justification for this is that people have to shop, and my message to you is don't buy it.
Family First Director Bob McCoskrey. The Shop Trading Hours Amendment Bill is due to be reported back to the House by April the 3rd. A day earlier, on Wednesday, a members' bill in the name of National's Chian Yang, seeking to ban convicted paedophiles from changing their name, ran into criticism from the Office of the Attorney General. In his opening address to the Social Services Committee, Attorney General's Office Advisor, Pasan Jaya Singh, said the Attorney General did consider that limiting the right of paedophiles to change their name was justified by a Section 7 test of the Bill of Rights, which weighs up justifications for limiting individual freedom of expression.
So applying this test to the bill, the Attorney General considered that protecting victims and potential victims of child sex offenders by managing and minimising the risk of harm caused by convicted child sex offenders is a sufficiently important objective to justify limiting the right to freedom of expression.
But while limiting the right of a paedophile to change their name was found to be justified, Mr Jaya Singh said the way Jiang Yang's bill attempted to do that was ineffective.
This is because there is no legal requirement presently to register a name to actually use it. A new identity is established simply when a person starts using a new name. And a person is not legally required obliged to give their registered name, address or any other information unless there are statutory requirements specifying otherwise. So this would mean that the bill's prohibition on child sex offenders changing their registered name will have a minimal impact practically on the ability for a child sex offender to use other names.
And there were other problems with the bill as drafted.
The prohibition would also not, in practice, prevent instances of child sex offenders committing identity theft or fraudulently using another name. So because of these reasons, it was found to not be rationally connected to the bill's objective.
Attorney General's Office Advisor Prasan Jayasinghe with that report on Jian Yang's Preventing Name Change by Child Sex Offenders Bill, which is due to be reported back to the House by June the 2nd. Also this week, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee continued its inquiry of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Public submissions on the TPPA are due in by March the 11th. To make a submission on that or other business before select committees, visit our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz, and click on Make Submission at the top of the page. In total, there were 15 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber, question time on Thursday saw what appeared to be a win for Labour's deputy leader, Annette King, in her epic battle to get Health Minister Jonathan Coleman to admit that National has cut spending on health.
Mr Speaker, my question's to the Minister of Health. What was core Crown health expenditure as a percentage of GDP in 2010-11 and what is it in 2015-16?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
Mr Speaker, the 2015 financial statements of the Government of New Zealand state that in 2010-11, core Crown health expenditure was 6.7% of GDP, and in 2015-16, it's forecast to be 6.4% of GDP.
That established, Mrs King closed in for the kill.
Well, in light of that answer, does a 0.38% decrease in Crown health expenditure as a percentage of GDP between the 2010-11 and the 2015-16 years equate to $930 million less going into health if the spending level had stayed the same? If so, when will he acknowledge that health expenditure has been cut?
But the Minister wasn't about to do that.
Honourable
What a silly question. It quite clearly has not been cut because it's gone up by $4 billion over the term of this government. So you better go and talk to your question writer.
The writer of Mrs King's questions was to be the subject of further questions. But first, as usual, Labour's deputy leader had been doing her homework.
I seek leave to table a parliamentary library document dated the 3rd of March 2016, compiled from data from Treasury, which shows exactly what I outlined in terms of core Crown health expenditure.
It may be useful to members. I'll put the leave us sought to table that information from parliamentary library. Is there any objection?
There was none, so it was on with question time and a patsy from one of his own backbenchers, allowing the minister to claim his health budget had been bigger than Labour's.
Mr. Yes. Speaker.
Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
I've seen advice that from 2000 to 2008, the average percentage of GDP spent on core Crown health expenditure was 5.7%. That's lower than the average of 6.5% during the term of this government.
The tit-for-tat exchange continued with another question from Mrs King.
If there is a real increase in Crown health expenditure, as he claims every week, why have DHB deficits increased by an unplanned $61.5 million year-to-date, 31st of December 2015?
Well, Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman. That's a big improvement on the $150 million-plus they were running at under Labour.
Then from tit-for-tat to tat-for-tit, with a question for the Minister from his benchmate and Cabinet colleague, Paula Bennett.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker, I'm wondering if the Minister has seen any reports on who might have actually written this primary question.
Mr Speaker, it's a numerate enough to be Grant Robertson.
Order. That's not a question, that's an order. It's not even described as a question.
Finally, the last question of the day on Thursday.
Question number 12, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Primary Industries. Does he have confidence in his Associate Minister of Primary Industries?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
the Associate Minister for Primary Industries.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes.
Not so many laughs, though, when the House resumed this week with the opposition using question time to put pressure on the government after some bad news from Fonterra on a lower payout for dairy farmers and Labor's exposure of a blowout on the Health Ministry's spending on the refurbishment of its Wellington head office. Question time on Tuesday found the Prime Minister, John Key, having to defend several of his ministers in his responses to questions from opposition leader Andrew Little.
How can he have confidence in the Minister of Finance, who had final authority over the unaffordable fit-out of the Health Ministry and failed to even check the Ministry's balance sheet?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Confidence in the Minister of Finance. I mean, this is the Minister of Finance that's seen strong economic growth, seen the books return to surplus, seen New Zealand growing and performing strongly on the world stage, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question. Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Mr Speaker, how can he have confidence in the Minister of Health when he covered up a, quote, serious failure of financial management within the Ministry, end quotes, including keeping the Auditor General in the dark, doing his best not to leave any paper trail, and hiding the cost from the public eye behind now a commercial lease?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I just utterly refute the assertions made by the member.
It's all documented. Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
What reports, if any, has he received from the State Services Commission on the cover-up in the Ministry of Health after Treasury called the Commission in to investigate?
The Right Honourable
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker,
I utterly refute the assertion the member's making.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
How can he have confidence in the Minister for Economic Development, who has made such a hash of the MB amalgamation that his own staff have been underpaid for years?
Order. Yes.
Order. Order. The question's been asked. It'll now be answered. Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, Mr Speaker, as I noted to the House last week, not only do I have tremendous confidence in the Minister of Economic Development, I'm very proud of the achievements that he's achieved. Just last week, we saw the export numbers for New Zealand be positive by $1.9 billion despite the downturn in dairy. We're seeing growth right across the regions for New Zealand. Mr Speaker, I accept that it's been a bit hard for some government departments to actually follow the rules set by Labor in the Holidays Act. But then, actually, members of the Labor caucus find it hard to follow the rules.
Order. I don't think where the answer's heading is going to help. Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Just what kind of shambolic government is he running when public servants aren't paid what they're owed and the Ministry of Health manages to hoodwink the entire cabinet into believing it had $24 million that didn't exist?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, 1 minute ago he was trying to say it was the Minister's fault. Now he's trying to say it's the Ministry of Health's fault. Mr Speaker, my understanding is that the issue's been dealt with. There have been some personal changes.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
With underfunding of health already running at $1.7 billion, just how is he going to pay for the latest bout of ministerial incompetence that's now costing taxpayers at least $1 million a year extra and a rack rent for the Ministry of Health?
Yes. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, firstly, the members are utterly wrong again about health, which funding is up over $4 billion in time that we've been in government. But I would point that the amount that's been paid in relation to the release, at least for the fit-out of Ministry of Health, actually comes out of their departmental expenses, which I will point out has been reduced from $230 million when we first became the government to $190 million. The personnel costs are reduced from 1,500 people to 1,100 people, Mr Speaker. So as we can see, we are running the department at a $40 million a year annual expenditure less.
After those questions to the Prime Minister from the Leader of the Opposition, the Minister of Health, Jonathan Coleman, faced questions from Mr Little's deputy and spokeswoman on health, Annette King.
When was he informed that the Ministry of Health request for capital injection to fund the fit-out of its new headquarters was not supported by Treasury and, quote, exposed a serious failure of financial management within the ministry, end quote?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
Mr Speaker, I was informed by the Director General of Health in mid-February 2015. The Director General advised me that he was calling in PricewaterhouseCoopers to both give advice on resolving the funding issue and to provide independent advice on improving the Ministry's financial management. I told Mr Chua very clearly that what had happened was unacceptable, that it would not happen again, and that the matter had to be resolved, and subsequently it has been.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
In light of the exposure of serious financial management problems within the Ministry of Health under the current Director General when he was acting in the role in 2013, did he raise any concerns with the State Service Commission before agreeing to the permanent appointment of the Director General in 2015? If not, why not?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
Mr Speaker, I think it's very unfair to go after a defenceless public servant, but what I will say is the State Services Commissioner was very happy to appoint Mr Chua because he was the best man for
the member job. Please resume, the Minister resume his seat.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. You accepted the question.
But I now want to hear the answer.
He wasn't answering it.
Can we now give the Minister an opportunity to answer the question? Well, then I didn't hear the answer, so I invite the member to ask the question again.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. In light of the exposure of serious financial mismanagement in the Ministry of Health under the current Director General when he was acting in the role from 2013, did he raise any concerns with the State Service Commission before agreeing to the permanent appointment of the Director General in 2015? If not, why not?
The Honourable, Dr Jonathan Coleman.
I think it's pretty bad form for the member to attack a public servant when he can't defend himself personally. But Mr Chua was appointed because he was the very best person for the job.
I'll allow the member an additional supplementary question because I don't think it's been answered.
No, thank you, Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Annette King, supplementary question.
Why did he not make the PricewaterhouseCoopers report into the serious financial management public after it was presented in June last year, rather than wait for it to be discovered through an Official Information Act request? Could the Minister please answer that question?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
Well, I know the member's trying to make out there's some sort of cover-up, but that's complete nonsense.
Supplementary question, the Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
Why did he only receive verbal briefings on the issue of serious financial mismanagement from the Director General of Health after he was informed there was a problem?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
I'm quite satisfied with the way that this whole issue has been resolved.
Point of order first,
point
Mr.
Point of order, the Honourable Annette King.
I seek leave to table a letter from the Ministry of Health to our research unit saying the Minister only received verbal briefings from the Director General on this matter.
Order, leave us sought to table that particular document. Is there any objections? There is none, it can be tabled.
Supplementary question, Mr.
Supplementary
Speaker.
Question, the Honourable Annette King.
What?
Order. Supplementary question.
The clown
Honourable
over there.
Order. If the Honourable Paula Bennett would prefer to leave question time, she's welcome. Otherwise, please cooperate. The Honourable.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What was the cost? What was the cost of the PricewaterhouseCoopers report, an inquiry which the Secretary of Treasury requested, and not the Director General of Health, even though he claimed he had asked for it on Radio New Zealand this morning?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
I'm quite happy to go and find the answer to that question for you, but I haven't got it on me now.
This is my last word. You gave me an extra, didn't you, Mr. Speaker? Yes, thank you.
Supplementary question.
Thank you.
The Honourable Annie King.
Thank you. Where will the Ministry of Health, to quote him, be finding that $18 million needed to pay for the refurbishment? Will it be coming from funding better used for health services? That's
right. The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Well, that's an excellent question. It's coming from the departmental expenditure. So under the Labor government, that was $230 million. We've reduced that to $190 million. There were 1,500 people in the ministry when Annette King was running it. There's now 1,100. But we're producing better results for New Zealanders. So very good question. Thank you. Good answer.
Question time ended with the Speaker, David Carter, revealing his decision on a request from Mr. Little for a snap debate.
I've received a letter from Andrew Little seeking to debate under Standing Order 389, the news of a serious failure of financial management at the Ministry of Health in relation to a building project. The news of the Ministry's inability to fund the building project from within the cash reserves as projected is a particular case of recent occurrence. The upcoming annual review debate offers an opportunity to debate the performance of government departments. This issue could be debated at that time. I do note, however, that the Health Committee has already presented its report on the annual review of the Ministry of Health. The issue was not raised in the report, and presumably the committee was not aware of it. The matter raised is a very serious one, and the sum of money involved is significant. The Treasury has expressed concern at the governance and financial management of the Ministry and has stated that it does not have, quote, confidence that the failures that occurred around the project will not reoccur. Having carefully considered this application, I believe it requires the urgent attention of the House. I therefore call on Andrew Little to move that the House take note of an urgent matter of public importance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Health
is
one of the biggest spending ministries and departments in the government. So what happens with the Ministry of Health matters. That's why good oversight matters. That's why you need a Minister of Health who is focused on the job and a Minister of Finance who is not asleep at the wheel. Unfortunately, we cannot say of the present Minister of Health nor of the present Minister of Finance that they are not across their portfolios and the Minister of Finance is not asleep at the wheel. This has been an absolute and utter failure of oversight by those charged with the responsibility of that oversight. A $24 million project, a $24 million refit project, that is a big project in government. And yet the Ministry of Health, its officials, no doubt aided and abetted by the Minister, because the Minister would know this was going on, is somehow able to persuade Cabinet that they've got the funds to do this project when the funds don't exist. How, Mr. Speaker, does that happen? How does that happen?
For the government, Health Minister Jonathan Coleman's response was both political and personal.
Mr. Speaker, every time I hear Mr. Little speak, I'm thoroughly reminded of why he couldn't win the New Plymouth electorate two elections in a row. And I tell you, there's one thing that unites the Labor caucus. It's the overriding feeling of boredom they get whenever they see their leader get up to speak. What none of the Labor caucus could see, Mr. Speaker, was right throughout that speech, Phil Goff and David Cunliffe were talking amongst themselves in the back row, because they've given up so much hope in Andrew Little, they couldn't even be bothered listening to their leader speak. And I've got a number of messages for Annette King, actually. But I tell you, Mr. Speaker, if she's going to let that doofus take over her seat at the general election, she's going to end up
Honourable
with some very...
The Honourable Annette King.
You, Mr. Speaker, you heard what the member just said, a disgraceful comment about the Leader of the Opposition. If he can't argue the issues, he shouldn't get on his feet at all.
Labor's health spokeswoman, Annette King, with that parting comment on Health Minister Jonathan Coleman in the snap debate on financial mismanagement in the Ministry of Health. The only bill to pass last week was the Radiation Safety Bill, and MPs acknowledged the plight of Pacific Islands devastated by Tropical Cyclone Winston and mourned the passing of Dr. Ranganui Walker and Martin Crowe. I'm Tom Fruin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.